This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 6th of April 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 248 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show this week, we'll explore the apartheid-era exploits of mysterious Frenchman Jean-Yves Olivier, as exposed in a new documentary, Plot for Peace.
He'd made a lot of money, he'd made a lot of contacts, he knew people all over the world, and I think he had a little conversation with himself that went something like this. Well, I don't have family, I don't have children, I'd like to leave behind something to be remembered by.
And in that vein, Michael Baer, author of a new book, Expat Etiquette, How to Look Good in Bad Places, will explain how to survive in unfamiliar territory abroad.
We'll also peruse the weird world of vernacular photography, as celebrated by Kessels Kramer Publishing in a new release, MeTV.
We'll also have next week's news today and a bit of music, all that here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So welcome, welcome, one and all. And hello, Andrew.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Okay. It's been a bit busy around here of late.
You know why that is?
Because I keep on saying yes to things.
Well, it's because you went on holiday.
Yeah, that wasn't a very wise move, it turned out.
To Portugal.
Well, that wasn't a holiday.
That was a holiday. You all went off to Portugal.
I'm sorry you were left behind, Steve. We went to see our dear readers. It was very nice indeed, except it rained the whole time.
It was sunny here in London.
I know, it was wet in Lisbon, but a very good crowd. We had 200 people turn up at the Geographic Society. They've got an amazing members club in Lisbon, this old school building. So you come through the entrance hall and it's this kind of massive entrance with all these kind of statues kind of lined up. And you go into this really beautiful, beautiful room, which is kind of wood paneled, nice velvet chairs, but kind of like a gentleman's club, probably like 1940 should be. And the day we went to check it out in the morning, we turned up and there was just a cleaner there. And she couldn't understand what we were saying, so she kind of just pointed up the stairs. There was no security. So we wandered upstairs and we started opening rooms where there's like some of the most valuable paintings and maps of the world that you've ever seen.
Is that what the new painting is in
yes.
your office?
Well, that's what the globe is on my desk. And we were just allowed to wander around. The other very nice thing is when you came through the front door, there was like one of those ping-pongs. But it made it sound like it was the gentleman's statue standing to your right that was making the noise. It wasn't actually.
It wasn't actually the statue.
That was my welcome to Lisbon. And we met really amazing people and lots of things going on there. And Portugal is a very good market for Monocle. And you realise why when you get there. Everyone speaks amazing English. People still read. Tons of bookshops. Great newsstands. And a very Monocle city. A place that still makes stuff and has good food and drink too.
It does have very good food and very good
drink.
You
can put that on the poster.
Yes. and also newsstands, which seems quite like us as well.
Yes, we were wandering around and we came across a kind of a news magazine shop, and the guy had filled his window with about 40 copies of Monocle plastered over every inch of his window. And I introduced myself and he said he sold like 50 copies. Just this tiny, tiny shop. 50 copies every single month, and wow. Had a nice chat with him. And then he came to the party as well,
aww.
Which was even better.
Well, there we are. Well, that sounds like a good use of your time.
We literally had members of the government and news agents all
that,
in
that
one
That sounds
room.
Like the perfect Monocle event, really.
Yeah, it was.
Lovely. Okay, well, that was what happened last week. Should we find out what's going to happen next week?
I hope so.
Let's bring in the magical, mystical Thomas Edwards.
Who knew the news could be so hot? Delivering a look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Baby. Who is that?
That's extraordinary.
That's quite an entrance.
I don't actually know who that is.
Investigation.
I almost
required.
Want to listen to it again, just to hear
it,
the voice.
It could be a quiz for people in the office, anyway. I'm not sure for our listeners, but I can't work it out.
I don't know how much fun they have each week with these. But let's keep going, nonetheless. Exactly. What more do you need than that?
Well, exactly. There is that, isn't there? Hello, Tom.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Andrew. How are you both?
I'm very good now. Now you're here.
Excellent.
I feel in safe hands.
I tend to usually have feel in safe hands before, when it was just you and I?
Well, you didn't have your hands on me.
Oh dear. We've started as we clearly mean to go on here today.
Tom's now scouring his list thinking, can I start with the serious item now? Possibly not.
Let's calm down.
Okay, let's start. Steve, I know you're very interested in this. Tomorrow, the polls open in India, the world's largest democratic election. We love a good election here at Midori House. And this is extraordinary. Just the numbers are amazing. Since the last national election, it used to sort of shifts in demographics in countries. 100 million people have been added to the electoral roll, give or take.
More first-time voters in India than the entire electorate in America.
I mean, isn't it, these figures are just almost impossible to comprehend. So that's why it does take them some time to put this vote together. Very interesting to see how it pans out. That all kicks off tomorrow. I know, Steve, you've been looking at this in more detail.
Ooh, I wouldn't want to be in charge of a recount.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine
damn it! I was 100 million and.
Interrupted. I mean, it would be, but just an extraordinary.
But also, it takes weeks and weeks to do the vote, let alone the count.
And interesting to chart. You know, the likely moves and shakers. Once they do finally work out who's won,
indeed,
then we can start speculating about what kind of job they'll do.
Okay, that's quite interesting.
So let's keep going.
That was big numbers story.
Big numbers, big style. Salone from Tuesday, of course. Monaco will be sending its usual delegation
from Tuesday. Our people seem to be going this weekend.
Well, they need to lay the groundwork.
All of them were like, "Oh no, we definitely need to start working on Saturday. Okay. In fact, we need to leave on the Friday."
Well, Tuesday, that's its kind of public opening, of course. But some of the big shots, like these characters from upstairs, Andrew here at Midori House, they need to be there a bit longer. But you know, extraordinary numbers again of big players from within the trade, people from overseas, everything you need to know about.
It's an amazing thing because it kind of takes over the city. So every kind of showroom, every store seems to put on something. Every art gallery is taken over as a kind of pop-up space, and then they have this amazing showground where you can walk for miles and miles and miles, just seeing everything that the world of furniture has to offer. So we've got Tom Morris, our design editor, is going to be there. Alid John. And Josh Fennett, who likes a bit of
our
prosciutto.
Our beauty editor.
Yeah, our beauty editor.
What a lineup that is.
It really is.
He's not really a beauty editor, but anyway. So they're going to be there, and there's going to be reports across Monocle 24 next week. Well, that's what I've told them anyway.
There will be. We'll crack the whip, Andrew, don't you worry. More people who will be shirking work. No, this is a terrible link. On Wednesday, Greek unions are holding a nationwide general strike against austerity measures. And it's interesting, I think, looking in Greece, these sort of economic travails continue. And, you know, there always seems to be this relatively fine line walked between industrial action and then a sort of wider dissent. So it'll be interesting coming week whether that sort of goes along without a hitch or whether it becomes a more of an ugly statement, not just about austerity, but about governance and governments generally, because often it seems to just be a demonstration about the ruling classes as much as about any specifics to do with economic policy.
And especially after there's been a crackdown on the far right and there's been big political manoeuvres over the last year, it'd be interesting to see who's out on the streets.
Very much so. Another thing on that day, Andrew, you remember last week I talked about the Marathon des Sables. Do you remember the Saharan desert trek, which is still underway now? They're probably dropping like flies. We're getting to the.
Have you ever considered this yourself?
I have considered it. I would love to do it, but it's interesting. I think it's possibly tomorrow, the big day, the 50 miler on the dunes there. I'm not sure.
Remind me, you do it in how many hours?
The winner does it in just under. Usually just about 19 hours. It is over a selection of days. I mean, I should point that out. You don't have to do it all in one go, the whole 250 kilometres.
Oh, I think you misled me last week.
Oh, did you think it was just all in one go?
Yeah, you said you'd do it in 19 hours or something.
Well, it's 19 hours. But
I didn't realise it was over the year.
Are you now thinking it's possible?
Pop in when you're free.
you're going to have a bachelor. No, so it's 3 days with a full marathon each day and then a double marathon.
God, less impressed or what? I thought it was kind of just running for 19 hours.
Do you now think it's achievable, Andrew?
No, I've got a bit of a dicky knee. So
the reason I bring that up...
If it wasn't for the dicky knee, you'd be right out there.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because obviously one of the problems there is the intense heat.
Yes.
50 degrees. So I found another marathon for next week. This might be more up your street, Andrew. It's just one marathon.
Okay.
26.2 miles. With me so far?
Yeah, where is it?
North Pole. So it's the world's coolest marathon. See,
coolest,
see what
really?
Done there. Yeah. 26.2 miles at the top of the world, just 6 to 12 feet away from the Arctic Ocean.
Do you need to say how long it is? Because surely a marathon is always the same length.
It is 26 miles, 385 yards. Do you know why specifically?
Why did you just say 22 miles then?
26.2
miles. 26.2 miles, okay.
Yes.
Yes, because that's the distance between the news agents and getting your marathon bar.
It's almost as prosaic as that, in fact. No, it was moved.
Wasn't it because of the...
No, but the
385 yards, wasn't that to do with the London Olympics?
Running past King George.
It had to finish
on one of the bridges over the Thames, I think possibly Westminster Bridge.
I thought it had to finish right underneath where the King was.
So informed on Monocle 24. The Weekly, the show that gives you the facts.
Although we both sound informed, but only one of us can be right.
And I'm pretty confident it's me.
Okay.
But let's move on. I've got one more. I've got one final story for you. Do you like this one? I've brought you a small prop as well. Look, this is a leaflet advertising this event, which is... This is today, Andrew. It is in Japanese.
Okay. It's the International Whistlers Convention.
This is a genuine event.
And what I like is about their kind of... their logo is all the letter O's are done as pursed lips.
So it's taking place in Japan, but it's organised by the International Whistlers Convention of Lewisburg, North Carolina. It's in its 41st year. Extraordinarily, it's apparently very big in Japan, and that's why it's taking place in Kanagawa this year.
Who's that little gentleman with the hat on in the corner and a ukulele?
He must be the champion whistler.
No, the master of ceremonies this year is a former grand whistling champion from the early 80s, and I think that might be him.
Are we sending anyone along to that? That strikes me as radio gold waiting to happen.
It could be. We may have left it a tad late.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably underway right now.
It's probably happened, hasn't it? Yeah. Okay.
Andrew, you look unmoved by that.
Was that a sigh or were you trying to whistle?
I can't. Can you know the thing you put in your... I can do that, the one, but I can't do the thing... Do you think they're allowed to do the one when you put your fingers in your mouth?
Do you know what? I don't know the specifics.
Are you saying...
I think it's all unassisted.
You had a... That sounds like a kettle. But, you know, people used to be able to do it in the school playground. It used to be that one, like, you could kind of like...
Yeah. The one with the things in your mouth, which
I can't
do.
A wolf whistle, I believe.
A deer would come out of woods and things once you've done it. So.
Now, this is just old school, no digital assistance whistling.
Well, there we are.
Now, in Portugal, let's bring it back to Portugal. They've got these funny little bird duck things. You put them in water, fill them up with water, and then you blow on them. Anybody can make the sound of a bird, like a really big bird, like a
that
vulture
would go down a storm
down.
At the International Whistlers Convention.
You could just pop one in your mouth.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
There we are. Okay. Cheating whistling. Next week, Tom, we might get your theme tune to be done purely by whistling.
That would be nice.
That would be great. That's a challenge for the gods behind the glass. Get cracking with that one if you can.
Tom Edwards, thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to speed with everything that's going to happen next week. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Lots of stuff, lots of proper stuff, frankly, coming up after this. Much has been said about the fall of apartheid, the sanctions, the international pressure and the efforts of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa that led to the release of Nelson Mandela and his eventual election as president in 1994. Not much at all has been said of the involvement of one man, a Frenchman known in a new documentary as Monsieur Jacques.
A former commodities trader, Monsieur Jacques, or Jean-Yves Olivier by his real name, used his contacts to influence events around Africa that would lead to the end of the apartheid era. For one, the 1988 Brazzaville Protocol that resulted in Namibian independence from white South Africa is said to have been brokered by Olivier. His exploits did not apparently earn him any money. In fact, he reportedly funded his ventures around the world with his own money. Award-winning filmmaker Mandy Jacobson, producer and director of Plot for Peace, joins us now from Johannesburg. Mandy, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, can you tell us how you came to a light on this gentleman who seems to have been in the shadows of history for so long?
Yeah, I run a project called the African Oral History Archive, funded by a private foundation, the Etchikovitz Family Foundation. And our mandate is to record the stories and the testimonies of people who've made a difference, contributing to South Africa's transition to democracy. And during our research and during our collection of many testimonies, we were interviewing African leaders, former foreign minister of South Africa, and came across a very curious piece of archive that spoke about Monsieur Jacques, who was being awarded a medal for his contribution to helping release a prisoner. So that, of course, alerted our attention. What was a Frenchman doing in South Africa working behind the scenes? And so we went back to Foreign Minister Pik Botha and thus uncovered a whole new story that we never even knew existed. we had to convince, obviously there was a process of tracking down Jean-Yves Olivier, and the whole point about Jean-Yves Olivier was that he didn't want to tell his story. Discretion had been his currency for 30 years on the African continent, so why should he indeed then reveal yet another part of South Africa's history that he had kept so quiet?
Mandy, it's a fascinating story, and it leads to one big question, which is, why did he do this? Why did, you know, this man that was, you know, making money quite happily, that didn't have necessarily a political dog in this fight, why did he get so involved?
It's a profound question, and it's a question that for the 3 years we've been working with him, we constantly have kept asking. And the answer that he gives is that if you're walking along, he actually says it like this, if you're driving along a road and you see an accident and you stop to help, then there's no profound motivation behind it where he had a master plan that said, I want to save South Africa. He saw an incredibly troubled situation. He was in a region where he wanted to obviously increase his business interests, and he therefore continued to use his business influence and make a difference. But he sat on his story for 30 years because I don't think at the time he had this plan that I wanted to go and save Africa, save Southern Africa, and then get rewarded for it. It was only 30 years later that he indeed then received an award from both the apartheid government and from Nelson Mandela's government.
Mandy, let's hear now some extracts from your film, including what Thabo Mbeki and others thought about Jean-Yves Olivier.
He never said one word about his contribution. I felt this small when I discovered who he was and why he was so sympathetic to our struggle.
I don't think he played a political role. He would have played whatever other role, but not a political one.
He would not have received a medal from Mandela if we did not appreciate his role.
When you have a man like Jean-Yves, nothing will leak, but the results will be brought about. And that's what he did.
The chance of being a double agent, we didn't care about this. We would not tell him what we didn't want him to know.
What he was looking for, I'm not sure, because he never asked me money. As a matter of fact, he spent a lot of money, especially in the exchange of prisoners, from his own pocket.
He'd made a lot of money, he'd made a lot of contacts, he knew people all over the world, and I think he had a little conversation with himself that went something like this. Well, I don't have family, I don't have children, I'd like to leave behind something to be remembered by. And Africa is a place where a single individual can still have quite a great effect.
Well, we heard there from Winnie Mandela, Thabo Mbeki and Michael Ledeen of the National Security Council, all describing Jean-Yves. Mandy, there seems to be still some mystery from all the people you've interviewed. Nobody's quite sure what he was up to. There's a hint there, was he an agent for the Europeans, especially for France? Do you think there is potentially some kind of murkier things in the background of this gentleman?
Well, I think history, you know, tells us has many fathers and many victories. And the point about Jean-Yves Olivier is that he was one of many different people that contributed in their own special ways. One of the points about the film is that we never wanted to set up this idea that one man ended apartheid, that one man was involved in the release of Nelson Mandela. So Jean-Yves' story just offers us another role into the many, many different stories, the many different narratives that bring about change at the southern tip of Africa.
But do you think that he could have been an agent for the French?
When we asked him that question, as I say many times, he would tell us that he had been accused of being an agent for Mossad, an agent for South Africa, an agent for the French. And I think, frankly, we'll never know.
Mandy, did he take much convincing to take part in your film?
Certainly. I mean, it was a lot. There was at least 6 months of trying to convince him why it was important to tell his story. And I think it had to do with the context of the African Oral History Archive, where we weren't just a group of filmmakers who were coming to tell his story and then potentially sensationalize the story, but that because of the African Oral Histories Archive mandate, which is to give some legacy and some roots to these testimonies, he was probably convinced. But there was a lot of arm twisting and a lot of trust building that had to happen because, as we say, he was a free agent. The word he uses in the film is electron libre. He was a free molecule. So he did his own work. He worked in his own ways. And why should he now begin to trust and hand his story over to somebody else?
Mandy, we're going to hear now again from someone else in your film, Leo Rusty Evans from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in South Africa, describing Johnny's relationships with France.
South Africa was feeling the effect of economic sanctions. The anti-apartheid movement and the ANC had succeeded in persuading the international community that South Africa should be isolated. The chairman of the Organization of African Unity, President Sassou Nguesso, had threatened the French government that if this took place, it would have consequences to the French-African relationship. Arriving in Paris and being told that the Prime Minister of France was unable to receive him, P.W. Botha was absolutely livid. But it was very clear that the intermediary, the person who had made the promise and set up the appointment as such, all fingers pointed to Johnny Valivier.
That was Leo Rusty Evans from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in South Africa. Mandy, what does this film tell us about the relationship between apartheid South Africa and France and, I guess, sort of the rest of the West during this period in the 1980s?
I think for me, as a South African growing up where you thought everything was so clear cut, there was an anti-apartheid movement, we supported sanctions, we knew exactly who the enemy was and we knew who our friends were and we knew who our friends were not. Johnny's story teaches us that there's a lot more to the murky world of politics and that indeed not entering the world of politics with strong ideology and a dogmatic ideology offers a whole new window into the world of negotiation. And I think that's what's been such an extraordinary journey for us in terms of learning that the parallel world of diplomacy is going on at the same time and often makes many more breakthroughs than the very strict ideological positions of don't speak to the South African government, we're only going to work through sanctions, for example.
And just finally, Mandy, could you just tell us, you know, obviously this is a moving thing, the history of South Africa. You imagine these amazing events, the release of obviously of Mandela, you know, that we know everything about it. But the work you're doing with the archive, does it leave you feeling that actually the history is still to be told?
I mean, that's the incredible privilege of working for the African Oral History Archive, is that there's so many stories. They're not only the stories of people who had access to resources, who were able to make a difference. They're the stories of so-called ordinary people, people who also in their own special ways have contributed not only towards democracy in South Africa, but towards the continent. And so we will indeed continue to tell the many stories and understand that history is not just told by the victors. There are many, many different voices that make up a country's narrative.
Mandy Jacobson, producer and director of Plot for Peace, thank you very much for joining us here on The Weekly, all the way from Johannesburg. It's music time here on The Monocle Weekly, and our culture editor may not be able to join us today, but he certainly left his mark. He suggested this track for us. It's Son with The Wheel.
That was The Wheel by Son, and it's from the album Tremors. We'll be back after this short break to examine yet more expatriate activities abroad, as examined in a new book, Expat Etiquette. Stay tuned.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage, and insight.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Brown.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin,
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietry.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Moldis.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now, from talking about the role of one French expatriate in Africa, let's broaden our horizons to look now at how all expats, yes, that strange bunch, interact with their unfamiliar surroundings. A new book by seasoned travellers Michael Baer and Liz Good attempts to outline how to look good in bad places. It's the subtitle of their new book, Expat Etiquette, and Baer and Good suggest that from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe, there is a distinct expatriate culture, a distinct lingo, a distinct way of dressing. To find out how he survived his own years abroad, co-author Michael Baer joins us now from San Francisco. Michael Baer, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Now, Expat Etiquette. There is a certain style one has to have, I guess, if they're going to be abroad. Before we get into what that style is, what was it that first inspired you to write this guide?
There were really two things that inspired me to write this guide. First, sartorially speaking, I realized that in some ways I was at my happiest with my wardrobe when I was overseas in a place like Afghanistan, and had the amazing realization that I could actually dress somewhat well, not well in any sort of dandified hipster sense of the term well, but well in a way that my beat-up chinos and my short-sleeved button-down shirt, I thought actually made me look quite dashing. And once I...
How modest of you.
Once I began to think that I looked somewhat dashing, I began to look around and realize there was no reason that others in a similar situation couldn't at least dress in a way that they could tell themselves that they looked dashing as well. The second inspiration behind this book was the fact that when you go to faraway places, they are almost by definition overwhelming. A different culture, a different context, a different language. And as human beings, our first instinct when we're faced with a situation that is overwhelming is to look lost, to look confused. Unfortunately, nothing marks you out as being more out of place in a place that you don't want to look out of place than looking confused. And so the real goal behind expat etiquette is to provide some lessons learned about how you can at least look like you know what you're doing, even if you have no idea what the hell is going on.
Talk us through some of the steps then of how to make sure you are looking good in a place where, let's face it, often it doesn't strike me as the easiest thing to necessarily do.
So there are two ways to look good. First, again, just in terms of dress, the most important thing is actually what not to wear. And there are really two rules of thumb there. First of all, you don't want to wear anything that you would be embarrassed to wear at home. So that Indian batik tunic that you bought that you thought you would always wear and sat in your closet for years and years, just because you're suddenly in India doesn't mean that you will feel any less self-conscious wearing it. Second, and a related point, there are precious few human beings who can pull off quote-unquote native dress. If you're wearing a shalwar kameez and you're not actually Pakistani, chances are you're going to look somewhat ridiculous. And it's hard to look good when you look ridiculous. So part of it is, again, how you dress. The other part in terms of how you act, there's a great expression, fake it till you make it. And when it comes to at least looking calm in somewhat disturbing situations overseas, the key is to fake it till you make it. And the key steps to faking it till you make it are, first of all, realizing that the bar to sounding like an expert in any country is incredibly low. So if you're caught in a conversation where people are throwing around names and tribes and dates and all the rest, and basically acting like they have a PhD on whatever situation they're talking about, it's easy to suddenly feel like intellectually you're on your back foot, when really all you need to participate in the conversation is to have a somewhat pained and attentive look on your face and to stroke your forehead a little bit, and then just memorize the name of a single town or a single tribe or a single date. And whenever someone is finished saying whatever intelligent thing they have to say, just say, oh, yeah, that's a great point. But how will that play in Nimile? Or how does that relate to what happened in 1963? And then just attentively wait for an answer. The other key part to sort of looking good by appearing to know what you're doing is, especially when things go pear-shaped, do what the person you most trust in the room or around you is doing. So let's say you're in Beletwane in Somalia and you're in a meeting in an office and you hear gunfire outside the door or outside the building. That is inherently a stressful situation. If the Somali person that you're talking to suddenly goes wide-eyed and drops to the floor, by all means, do the same. If he just seems totally calm and keeps on talking, then swallow your fear and continue the conversation. It's really just an issue of trying to find, in whatever situation you're in, a local guide. And by local guide, I simply mean someone who is there who seems to know what she or he is doing and then doing what they're doing.
To go back to the actual clothes, there's a couple of types of foreigners in foreign land, particularly within the aid sector, that have a certain style which isn't necessarily one to recommend. One is the ubiquitous NGO T-shirt with the name and logo of your organisation. I'm sure you've seen a few of those in your time. And the other is the... this is particularly amongst a certain type of Brit, the khaki blazer and Panama or straw boater. Can either of those outfits ever work, or are they both kind of doomed?
I'd say that the NGO T-shirt is only acceptable if one is exercising and sweating profusely. Otherwise, no. The boater, certainly not. The khaki vest, or as I like to think of it, the action vest of many pockets, again, certainly not. Your chances of going right wearing any of those things are infinitesimally small.
Let's talk about facial hair, Michael. Now, I know that you're a man with a beard, and, you know, having a beard is perhaps not a bad thing in countries in certain parts of Africa or in the Middle East, whereas perhaps a little bit easier to look good with a scraggly beard than to worry about when you're next going to shave. What's your beard etiquette?
I think, Steve, that we might be in roughly the same situation, in that we went overseas when we were relatively young and quickly found ourselves talking to people who were significantly older. And I found there's nothing more effective to make yourself look older than 25 than some sort of facial hair. That said, anything that gets too big and too bushy, A, I think just aesthetically doesn't look that pleasing if it looks like a bird is about to nest in your beard. And second, in hot climes, can actually just be quite uncomfortable. So there's a fine line. I like to think of it as the 1 to 3 week scruff mark. It's hard to go wrong.
Okay, what 1 to 3 week scruff? Well, from what I can recall as well, you're always within that 1 to 3 week scruff zone, which is good. Is there a serious side to this book? Is there if I'm a young would-be expat going to a part of the world where I'm not going to necessarily feel confident of either what I'm doing or how safe I'm going to be, is actually part of this about trying to make individuals feel, yes, just a little bit more confident and able to give an air of they know what they're doing and that they're comfortable with what's going on?
Through all the jokes and humorous advice, there's a really serious streak that runs through it. And what my co-author and I tried to do was distill the most important lessons that we learned from our time in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Liberia and elsewhere. Because what we'd found was, especially when we first went overseas, it's an oral culture of advice. So you'd get advice by talking to people who'd been there. But before you leave, there's no resource to turn to. I mean, there are memoirs, which can be fascinating. But in terms of actual concrete advice about what it's like and what you should do, we thought was sorely lacking. And so we hope that at least to some extent and in some small way, this book helps fill the gap. And it's not just sort of what to wear or how not to look confused, but also rules of the road when it comes to navigating what are potentially very dangerous situations. It's not just advice about sort of how do you realize what minefield markings are or what should you eat or what should you not eat, or how do you know what kind of disease you have and when should you be concerned. But really, beyond all that, it boils down to what we think is the key piece of advice, which is, and it sounds cliched, but it's true, when you're going to someplace difficult and you've never been before, the most important thing is to simply trust your own instincts. And what we try and do with this book, beyond the humor and beyond the real advice, is to reassure people that you will most probably be fine if you trust your instincts.
Michael Baer, author of Expat Etiquette, or co-author rather, of Expat Etiquette, How to Look Good in Bad Places. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
If you thought Vancouver fashion was just about open-toed sandals and fleeces, think again. Local clothing brands are on the rise, giving the city a stylish boost. Monocle Films headed to the West Coast to meet forward-thinking retailers.
We first opened this location in Chinatown in 2011, and it was really new at that time. There wasn't too much really going on in the neighborhood. We're pretty much one of the only ones on the block. But since then, it has grown quite a bit. It's become a really great little, kind of like if you know, then you know kind of places.
Fashion City, Vancouver. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Today, photography is everywhere. Hundreds of millions are uploaded to social media sites every day. Most people can snap away with their phones. It's now perhaps right to assume that much photography has not much thought put into it. The pre-digital age inevitably saw less photography, and maybe more thought put into what was shot and how.
One publishing house prides itself on collating images from the strange world of vernacular photography in order to learn more about the time period captured. Kessels Kramer Publishing has just brought out a new book, MeTV, which features 8 found snapshots of a Chinese woman standing in front of her television. And Eric Kessels, its publisher, joins us now from Amsterdam. Eric, you've done a lot of work in this area, in the strange world of kind of found art almost in photography. Just tell us a little bit about this book. It's literally 8 pictures of a woman and her TV, isn't it?
Yeah, in this case, it's. I mean, what I often do is that I go to flea markets on certain areas all over the world and try to find their interesting stories in other people's albums. In this case, I found it in Beijing together with a friend of mine called Thomas Sauvin, who's living in Beijing. He has kind of the same passion. And we found this album from the 80s, where this was also the moment that people got a television in their home. And they were kind of proudly presenting their new television, which was kind of a status symbol at that time. But in this case, it was a woman who... her husband probably made like a series of 8 pictures, and she stands exactly, identically and exactly in the same position in every picture, but then has in every picture a different clothing on, which makes it quite bizarre. And her pinky is kind of always exactly in the same position on the cupboard where the television is on, so that's quite strange. And that, in a way it tells also, there's a kind of a mysterious story behind that.
So, Eric, for you, with all these projects, is the idea that you take something that's a found item, that's something, obviously the people who took these pictures and appeared in them, the woman who appears in them, she didn't think that she was making art at the time, but you're the way that you present it, its publishing, the execution that you add to it, do you think that turns it from being, you know, just domestic photography actually into art?
I mean, the thing is that often, of course, when these albums are on the market, often the people that own them are dead, and I mean, and they also have no family anymore to pass it on to. And with the first stuff that I found, I was quite kind of, I kept it for a while, and there was a beautiful story. This was about 400 pictures that I found in Barcelona on the market, and there was kind of a beautiful story in there. And then in the end, I thought it's quite nice to give these images that are kind of anonymous a second life, and to show them to people, and to take them out of its original content and bring them into a new one. It gives a different meaning. And but generally, what I look for is often these very specific stories. I mean, 99.9% of all the family albums are very boring. I mean, they. People are generally boring with their photo camera, but it has nothing to do with, I mean, people are at the moment still quite boring with their photo camera, but I'm looking specifically for the ones, for a series of pictures that these amateurs kind of, and I mean that in a good way, but the amateur photographers make kind of a narrative out of it without that they even knew it.
And Eric, how much of the story do you know behind the photos before you publish them? Do you feel like you need to know exactly what they were doing, what their intentions were? Or is that something that you feel you can work out yourself, or the people buying the book can work out for themselves?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I mean, often, of course, I don't know the name of, or I don't know exactly the story. And for instance, I found this album where I found about 80 or 90 pictures of a twin, a non-identical twin that was wearing the same clothing in every picture. And at a certain moment, they get like a friend. This was in 1946, and they get a friend, and the friend is standing in the middle, in between these two girls. And then that is the last picture where they ever appear on together. And then you see only pictures with the smaller one of the two twins appears on her own, and she almost stands left or right of the picture, so she leaves like a little bit of space for the missing sister in that picture. But I mean, I had about 10 or 15 albums of that family, and I never saw the woman appearing back in the image. So I mean, I edited the book. But maybe they were not sisters, because they didn't look like each other. But it's kind of strange if you have about 30 different sets of outfits. And I sometimes recreate the story, and I'm also you act a little bit like a detective and or archaeologist, because you don't know the complete story, but you. And it's nice also that people kind of, when they see the book, that they can also make their own story. Because, for instance, with the woman, the first images that I found was 12 years of a photographer who photographed his wife. And so only she was on the image for 12 years on holidays. And but only when I started to look at the dates of the pictures and put them behind each other, you saw that further in time, so maybe after 10 years that he photographed her, he pulled back, and you saw the woman more and more disappearing in the background. And so that must have indicated that he had lost a little bit of interest in its subject, or he had more eye for the surrounding. But I mean, you find these kind of awkward things that happen in albums.
Eric, you know, you're talking about some quite deep, emotional things about people's lives and separation and people's relationships. But you certainly have an eye for the absurd and the funny too. And one of the things that you've done in the past was a series of pictures called How Not to Photograph Your Black Dog. Could you tell us a little bit about this?
No, it's not really How Not to Photograph Your Black Dog, but it's more, I found an album in New York on a market where a family was kind of fighting against one of the big mysteries in photography, and that's how to photograph your black dog. And that is something which is quite difficult. And this family, in a way, they failed constantly in that. So over the years, they started to photograph the dog, but it was just like a big black cutout almost in the picture, and or a black phantom. And so when they are with the dog on the picture and they embrace the dog, you see just a black spot sitting next to them. And also they decided to have a black sofa in the house, which doesn't help either. And even outside, when they photograph the dog in sunlight, they managed to put the dog in front of another big shadow. So then it disappeared as well. So it was almost like, very funny that they made all these mistakes. And that's something also quite crucial, I think, because a lot of, I really like the work of amateurs because they are very open to make mistakes. I mean, nowadays we have an application on our phone to kind of make mistakes with our photographs, to make them look bad or to make them look, which, I mean, that also shows that we are looking for a certain authenticity in an image. And but amateurs, they create mistakes without being shamed about it, or and that is quite nice. This family, in a way, in the end, they started to they got pretty frustrated, and because of the black dog and because of the pictures, of course. And then they started to overexpose the image heavily. So then there was one image in the album where everything was totally bleached out, the background, and then the dog, finally you saw a little bit of the eyes of the dog, but the rest was all totally bleached out.
And Eric, just finally, we mentioned before that this is obviously a digital age for photography. We're all taking photos all the time, but we rarely actually seem to ever get around to printing them these days. Have you found that it's getting a little bit harder for you to find photo albums that are a little bit more recent?
No, of course, the photo albums on markets are slowly disappearing. But I'm not hooked to the physical photo album. I mean, I also look on internet, on Flickr, and I recently found a fantastic series of a family from Florida where her husband photographs his wife. The husband photographs his wife constantly when the wife is with her clothes in the water. And that's something I found on Flickr, and then I contact the people and I show them the other books I did, and then they like to show that to the rest of the world. And then but there is, of course, there's more physical photo albums because that's slowly disappearing. I mean, in a way, it's been a phenomenon that has been maybe 90 years with us. But of course, there's other photo albums now. There's the digital, the photo streams, and where you can find things, and so that doesn't really change. The physical album looked often more like a scrapbook and like something where people wrote captions on. So it's more tactile, and that is of course different now.
Eric Kessels of the Kessels Kramer Publishing in Amsterdam, thank you very much indeed for coming on the Monocle Weekly.
Well, that's all for edition 248 of the Monocle Weekly. Steve?
It is indeed.
Yeah, it was good. I like the idea of whistling competitions.
Yes, I think we should have an in-house Monocle. In fact,
have an in-house
fair.
Whistle.
Yeah, the summer fair, we could do a whistling. Actually, that might offend the neighbours.
Yes.
Or in fact, just us, generally.
And some people would be better at it than us, I think, as well. But I think the idea of getting people to whistle the theme tune for Tom Edwards next week is quite nice.
Okay. We'll see what we can do on that.
Do you think people could get their lips around Tom Edwards? I don't know. We'll have to see. It's quite a complicated thing to whistle, I think. But we'll see. Maybe. Who knows? I think plenty have tried. But it's been a bit of a challenge in the past. But I think that somebody...
Why I find this so funny.
I think that somebody could just about pull it off. Okay. should we potentially say goodbye to people?
Yeah, I think
let's tell them. This show was produced by Alad John, and our studio manager, well, it wasn't Jack Phillips today, it was Claire Urban.
Whistling Claire Urban,
yes.
Some call her.
We're going to be here again next week.
Hopefully,
if we haven't been fired. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.